Like
I don't understand why you have to dig so deep into it.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Mod State Podcast. This is your host, Nate, here. Yes, it's a solo podcast today. Get one for the new week for you, although it sounds like a lot of you listen whenever you can, so it may be the end of the week, your weekend, or the beginning of the week. Who knows? Either way, I hope your day is going well. Pleasantries aside, happy to be back, and we've got some listener questions tonight from New Zealand. So we'll have some Commonwealth questions about some things that are going on in the United States, and I think are interesting. I think a lot of us, when we hear these questions, and we'll really only talk about two because I think they're fairly symbiotic, because I think the argument here for these two questions in the United States fall under the same category of rights and federal oversight, but we'll get into that. As always, you found us somewhere to listen, whether that's Spotify, whether that's Stitcher, iTunes, or Podomatic. But wherever you are listening, continue to do so. As always, to go to modstate.com for more op-ed and opinion pieces. And, of course, YouTube. We're there now. So you can see how I look compared to my voice. So maybe that's horribly disappointing for some people, but, well, tough. That's what you got. Okay, so this is, and I'll leave her name nameless, but it's someone I do know from down under in New Zealand. And she sent a very thoughtful email to me. It sort of started with, "Hey, I've really enjoyed your podcast. I try to listen." And I said, "That's awesome. Let me know your thoughts." And promptly I got several pages of thoughts and notes and some very thought-provoking questions in context to someone who is looking at America outside of it, so sort of a bird's eye view of what's going on, and unfortunately, I do believe that, you know, negative press is good press, I guess if that's what they say, and you may not get all the positive spins, and it's hard to really dig into what's going on at a cultural level in a country that's so big and when you're so far away. However, there's a lot of crazy shit going on. And I do recognize that. So I think America today is under far more of a cultural and political microscope than it has been. And maybe I'm wrong there, but there's just so much tribalism and political tribalism and, you know, cultural barricades that are coming up that the questions that she poses are good questions. And I think a majority of Americans would tend to agree with her. Or I should step back and say, excuse me, not a majority of Americans, but a good portion of Americans will feel like-minded with some of these questions and would propose these and say, yeah, what is going on with this? Why is that this way? So let's just get into this. So the first question is, excuse me, she said, "What is the deal and why was there a law passed that stops any federal monies going towards research into harm from gun deaths? If gun ownership is so innocuous, then the research will show this. Are you more likely to come to harm if you own a gun? The rest of the world is completely flummoxed about why this is so difficult an issue for the U.S. to address. Arm the teachers? You've got to be kidding." Well, I tend to agree. So what is the matter with these people? Who are they? Who is suggesting this? So first off, just to kind of dispel, I don't think there was any law that was necessarily passed that stops federal monies to go to gun research. I just think it was squashed. So there wasn't anything or any grant or any monies appropriated for that specifically. The CDC, the Center for Disease Control, within the United States and for definitely works in all parts of the world, does have money to study this. They have money to do research. The National Institute of Health, NIH, can also do this. And then independent groups can also fund research for gun violence. And there have been studies done. I'll cite a couple of them here. But at the end of the day, I think where we struggle here is that it doesn't matter what the research does show, whether it shows a positive or it shows an overwhelmingly negative. And, you know, I can pull up stats here to just sort of just pave the way for this. I mean, there's a study, and of course I will absolutely put these in the show notes. So there's a study that showed that a New Yorker is just as likely to be robbed as a Londoner, for instance, but the New Yorker is 54 times more likely to be killed in the process. Now, I do realize if you do listen to We the People Live with Josh Zepps, that he had a podcast about this, and I think he went through this entire New York Times article. So if you've heard some of these statistics before, it's sorry. I'm not sorry. Sorry, not sorry. It's what it is. And I do think you should go listen to that podcast specifically, and then, of course, read this article that I'll link. But it doesn't matter. Even though that's you're 54 times more likely in New York to be shot than in London, but equally able to be robbed on either, you know, that side of the pond or in New York, that doesn't matter, because what this fundamentally gets to is the right, and that it was crafted in our Constitution, that it was a right to bear arms. And really, most people won't be moved by any negative statistic that comes out. Anything that points... So there's another statistic that 60% of gun deaths are, I think it's something along those lines, are by suicide, or I should say 60% of suicides are by guns. Either way, that's staggering. But what it comes down to are law-abiding gun owners who say, listen, this is my right. I have the right to defend myself. I have the right to have this weapon as a means of protection against the government. I have this means of, I have this weapon or this gun, shotgun, handgun, whatever you want to call it, as a means of recreation. And no one's going to take that from me. So this sort of ties in to the second question. And it's a little bit more about socialism. And I'll read it right now because I think we're going to talk about these fairly, or the point of rights and federal oversight together, and it fits with both of these topics. So the second question is, why do the majority of Americans think that socialism is such a terrible thing? In particular, socialized medicine. The precedent has been set in the U.S. for some aspects of socialism. So she goes on to talk about Social Security, albeit there's some troubles due to sustainability, she notes. I note that the happiest places to live are Finland, Scandinavia, countries like New Zealand and Australia are all fairly socialistic. Only problem is, weren't these countries that Donald Trump wanted immigrants to come from? Only problem is they're quite happy where they are. Very true. But again, this sort of like gun rights and owning a firearm is like kind of like socialism here, okay? I don't mean it is like socialism, but what I mean is there's a hardwiring in the American people to look at specific things like gun rights, which I think there's a cultural shift happening slowly. Just like the idea of socialism, and not socialism, but socialist-type ideologies or things that we put into action, like universal healthcare. We don't label that as socialized medicine. We do to a degree, but we really call it universal healthcare. There's a cultural shift and there's a cultural move towards that. But why is there a pushback there? Well, the pushback's it's fairly obvious to me, and may not be to someone on the outside looking in, that things like socialism or socialist ideology has been so grafted, this rejecting that idea is so grafted into the American people from even like a civics, seventh grade civics class or social studies class, that democracy reigns supreme. This is a representative government is the right way forward. Limited federal government is, and states' rights is very important. So when you begin to have conflict when people discuss or introduce the idea that more people are giving more of their hard-earned money, or they're making less for what they work for, or I should say, you know, they're giving more of their money in taxes, essentially, that's an attack on the individual, the pursuit of happiness, the pursuit of liberty. And so, again, it comes down to a right. And I'm not saying that this is right or wrong. I'm just saying this is the fundamental fabric of America. This is the this is something that was so it was the foundation of and I'm sorry, but it was limited federal government. It was having state sovereignty. And when you begin to impose the or planting the seed that, hey, the federal government's, we're going to do this for you. We're going to make universal health care. Yes, it's a little bit more socialist. We're going to give a little bit more for everybody. I don't think it's that people don't want to give to people, or I think some people would argue, yeah, that's kind of the case. People are assholes. But yes, there's always going to be dickheads. All right, we can all agree with that. However, it's giving up rights for something else. So giving up your gun rights to make a better society, a safer society, that's just more of an encroachment of the federal government into your life. So more regulations into owning guns, that is, or weapons, that's an encroachment of the federal government. And just like socialism, or the idea of a socialist ideology, is the idea of the federal government sort of encroaching on your rights. And until we break through that barrier, the idea that this negative connotation that we have with, I guess, and it sounds negative when I say it, that we are giving up a little bit for the greater good in the idea of socialism to help everybody. We're giving up and making it harder to purchase a weapon. We're making it harder to sell a weapon. That's an encroachment of the federal government, and it's taking your right away, and that's a slippery slope. The other thing I'll say about this, about socialism, is you have to understand as well that where the United States has been, and the world has been there too. I mean, the world was not immune to the Cold War. I mean, the world was pretty much going to be a casualty of the Cold War if anything did happen. However, we fought, you know, it's the Red Scare. We fought this this monster. We were protecting ourselves against this communist socialist monster. Now, was it far broad, and is communist Russia today well removed from socialism? Yes. Is socialism a closer step to that than the democracy we have today? Probably. I think if we were playing leapfrog, or if we were, you know, I think it's a little closer on the trajectory. But there's a negative connotation here in the United States with socialism. There's a negative connotation that is a slippery slope to something like communism. And again, I think these two things just come back fundamentally to the rights of people. And it's interesting it is interesting that we don't have more federal monies towards the research of gun violence. I mean, that's a really good question to say, if it's not there, then the research will show that. However, the independent research is showing just the opposite, that we do live in a fairly, possibly more violent United States in relation to other countries that have guns, or don't have guns, rather. It's true that America is, I think we have 4.4% of the global population, but 42% of the guns, and 31% of gunmen and mass shootings worldwide were American, and that was in a 2015 study. So, yeah, it's almost as if we want to find, especially when it comes to gun violence, that it's something else. And that it's mental health, and that we need to put more money towards that. And as noble as I think it is to put more money towards mental health, it doesn't hurt to know more about something that we are, that a huge majority of Americans have in their own house, and that's weapons. And something to say. I mean, this article goes to say, if mental health made the difference, then the data would show that Americans have more mental health problems than other countries with fewer mass shootings. But, is that true? I don't think that is. So, it's strange. I could imagine being on the other side of this, or a bird's eye view looking into this and seeing things like, arming teachers as a solution to a problem. And I think that's a very flimsy band-aid to a gushing wound. And I think most people recognize that. And I'm sure there's a small majority of people out there that believe that absolutely could solve or deter people from shooting a school or a movie theater or something like that. But I think most Americans find that fairly preposterous. And, you know, the one thing that we do have here in the United States that may be different from other countries, although the British have a society, or I should say a nonprofit group, that's very similar to this. In fact, the National Rifle Association, NRA, was actually created after the Civil War, and I believe after the British National Rifle Association was formed. About a year and a half earlier. And it really started with, we'll just take a step back further. I mean, the Constitution, I mean, there's the Second Amendment literally says you have the right to bear arms. And it's a very vague document, or I should say part of the document, that both sides would either like to interpret just as is, or believe that is flexible, or that it's sort of archaic. And, you know, John's not here to defend this, and so I feel it's a bit one-sided, but, you know, I firmly believe, and I have nothing to really back this up, that I don't know that the Founding Fathers really intended for the Constitution to be as fixed as it is. You know, even Thomas Jefferson himself rewrote the Bible the way he you know, translated, or not translated, rather, but interpreted it and what he thought was right. So I can't imagine that he would be part of the Founding Fathers movement and have this Constitution that he believes is this absolute fixed document. But, you know, the one thing is the Founding Fathers did not foresee AR-15s. They did not. And they didn't foresee the internet, or not that was ever written about, that they foresaw that. And I would imagine that there may be, I would hope that there would be a desire for a bit of flexibility with what's going on in the United States today. But again, that's maybe my hopes and dreams, and screw those, right? But the NRA really was began as a club, I guess, or an organization that started with a rifle range. It was devised to help people become better marksmen for the U.S. military. It taught civilians how to handle weapons, and this really went on for a while. It was an amateur rifle. It wasn't. Excuse me. They formed a rifle club. They fought, or they competed against other countries, and it really wasn't until the 1934 National Firearms Act that came into place, where there now was an excise tax on certain materials used for weapons. The bill paved the way for national registry of weapons, certain weapons. I think it began as weapons under barrels under 18 inches, concealable weapons. There's a whole list of different type of weapons that you had to register, and that's really when weapon legislation or firearm legislation really became a hot button issue. And then it was again in 1968 with the Gun Control Act of 1968. And you know where this stemmed from, folks? Specifically 1934 was after Prohibition, and this was specifically for because of gangland crime and Prohibition violence. So there was a need to go ahead, and of course now we had, you know, you can think of the Tommy gun. Now we're talking about more high-powered weapons, and there was something that needed to be done, and so they did this. And this is when the NRA really started to have more of a political front, a political action group, and political expansion. And this continued to go into in 1977 when it expanded its membership and really formed coalitions with conservative politicians. And that's where we really start to see this marriage of conservatism, republicanism, if you will, and gun control. And you have, of course, I mean, you have conservatives who generally look for less federal government and more individual rights. And so the idea of a federal government encroaching on your right, your inalienable right, Second Amendment right to a weapon. This is where this marriage began, and I think very quickly after that, they became the one or two most powerful gun lobbyists or lobby group in D.C. So this is just a little bit of that background, and honestly, it comes down to rights. It comes down to the encroachment of the federal government into your life to take those weapons away. Now, of note, in Australia, they, after Port Arthur in early 90s, they effectively took out the right to defend yourself as a reason and justification for gun ownership. You can no longer buy a weapon for the reason of self-defense. And today, in the United States, that's a cultural fabric. That's a cultural fabric of owning a weapon. I mean, if you were to ask any, let's say, multiple gun owner or just an individual that had a 38 special in their nightstand, why do you have that weapon? Why do you hold that weapon in your car? Self-defense. It is for my self-defense. Now, stripping that away in the United States would be cataclysmic. It would be apocalyptic to take that away. And I don't know that I'm advocating for that, because that fabric runs so deep in this country. And until we move, you know, I think culturally we're always ahead. The culture moves. I mean, we see this with pot reform, right? So about 64% of all Americans agree that it should be taken off the schedule and decriminalized or just be legal. But it's going to take a while for politics to catch up with that. And as the cultural tide begins to shift here, especially with gun rights, this will take a very long time to see any action or any movement politically, as it will be culturally. I think people are just fed up here with people dying. I mean, we don't hear about the inner city gun violence either. And that, I think that if that was brought to light more, I think there'd be even greater outcry for that. But I won't really go into the things I think we could do. I think the question really just says, why is this research gone? And like, what really the question is, what's the deal? What's going on over there? Like, why can't you get your shit together? And the question, I mean, like I said, I think I just laid out why. It doesn't make up, it's not an excuse for not having research into gun violence. It's not an excuse for any of this. It's not an excuse for greater regulation. It's just what it is. And until we can, you know, maybe, I think part of it is just the way we talk to one another about this issue. And I had an Instagram conversation with a guy who posted some meme about people taking their guns away. And I approached, people hate centrists, and I realize that's what I am, but I approached it from his perspective. And then I laid out why I thought it was important that, or the ways we could enact some reasonable legislation and monitoring, I guess, I suppose, or maybe that's not really a good word, but regulation. And at the end, it said, look, we had some apologies, and he said, look, I've been attacked about this. People just want to take my guns, and this is what I've heard. And it just worries me, and this is what I've been doing. I've just been berated for this, and I just didn't have a moment to breathe. And I realized that we're kind of on the same side here, and I think some of the things you're proposing would work. So I think a lot of this has to do with language and how we speak to one another. And of course, when bad stuff continues to happen, the side opposing that bad stuff happening is going to get louder and louder and louder. And the more, I would say, to the right, the more you barricade yourself, the louder the other side is going to yell, and the more action is going to be taken. So I spent a lot of time on the gun right thing, but I think for just socialization, I would say, and I don't know if I said this before, but the majority of Americans think that socialism is a terrible thing. I think there's a lot of Americans that see value in socialized or universal entitlements or programs. And when I use the word entitlement, that's what triggers the other side, that who's entitled to what and why are they entitled to it? And why are they entitled to it? Why are they entitled to the money that I make? And this is not a very charitable or very Christian value to have. And there's another question she has, or more of a comment about Christianity and collective responsibility in other countries, specifically the Commonwealth countries, where the Christian church aligns more with these kind of social collective responsibilities. And I don't know where that went. And I think a lot of people in the Christian communities in the United States would argue that it is there. Yet for a lot of outsiders, they're still looking. And a lot of this has to do with how you align yourself politically. And if you are aligning yourself politically as a conservative, and conservatives are, for, you know, a better sense, trying to cut these entitlement spendings, that it does look fairly uncharitable. And I think this is the bird's eye view looking in, is saying it looks very uncharitable. Look at us. Like, we do take some collective responsibility here. So why can't you? And I think, again, it comes back to, you know, what the Declaration of Independence says, what the Constitution says, that you have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And that part of that liberty and part of that pursuit of happiness is a government that doesn't intrude in your life. And that you have a state that is fairly independent of the federal government that is making laws. And that any federal encroachment of any that somehow takes a right away from you, that's the ideology, and that's the slippery slope people are talking about. Now, I do think there's a cultural shift that we're having, where I think people see a broken healthcare system because they're dealing with it themselves, and they're realizing that there has to be a better way. How do we do this? How do we make this better? And instead of going to a free market where it's a Taco Bell menu at every primary care provider that you go to, at the end of the day, I think people are more amenable to the idea of paying into a system that they can go anywhere in the United States and access, as opposed to breaking your arm and going to an emergency care clinic and looking at the menu going, okay, $1,000 for that. Like, well, I'm at $1,000, so I guess I'll splint it with this 2x4 outside. That they're paying into it, and that they can reap the benefit from that. And I think that cultural perspective is shifting. However, it's going to continue to be very hard if we view socialism the way we do in the United States, as an encroachment on the rights and the liberties of the citizen. And we have a long way to go with the conversation, how we craft this and how we market this. I think Sarah, my fiance now, Sarah, we got engaged, shout out. And she says that science has a poor marketing, they have a marketing problem. You know, science is what it is, but they have a marketing problem. They need to market it better. And I think as we move on, I think this idea of these sort of universal programs need to be marketed better. Because a lot of people, and I'll pick on the right here, a lot of people are using these programs, but are, you know, they're still conservative, and they absolutely have a right to be conservative, but they can't bitch about the programs that they're reaping benefits from. And a lot of that, I think, has to do with a bit of education of what these programs are. And I realize I'm picking on the right hugely right now. I realize that, but I mean, if you're left leaning and you're progressive, and you're benefiting from these programs, you're probably in favor of those anyway. So there's not as much hypocrisy there on that side. Anyway, these are the muddled thoughts and responses to at least two of these questions. We've got several more, and John and I will hopefully be getting to these when we can get back together and get back on YouTube. But I just wanted to let you know that people from the Commonwealth and from all over the world are watching American politics, and they watch it very, very closely. I think she said, I went to India in October, and on my way, I traveled a bit off the beaten track and ended up in the Himalayas staying with a mountaineering family. The old lady there was a simple village lady and was really upset and worried about President Donald Trump. At first, she thought I was from the U.S. How can it be that he has upset even people who live in subsistent lifestyles in such remote places? She was so upset about the pollution and the air resulting from climate change and added the U.S. withdrawal from the Paris Accord. So that's something else to talk about, but it's people do follow American politics more than they do quite a bit. So if you ever travel, There's a lot of people out there that can go toe-to-toe in American politics with you, and it's quite interesting. But anyway, as always, my friends, it's a pleasure. Thank you for your listenership and your support as always. And it's always a pleasure to bring my voice to your ears. I don't know if it's a pleasure. That's kind of weird, but I enjoy doing it. And I hope that your day is going well and continues to do well. So until next time.